This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Tale as Old as Time, Why Fairy Tales Endure.
Now, we're both quite excited for this week.
Yeah, considering we didn't have a huge plan for this one, but this is definitely in our wheelhouse.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been a very long time, because we did a fairy tale episode quite early on. And I think, you know, it's inevitable that when talking about speculative fiction, fairy tales come up. So, you know, we've obviously discussed them several times. But it is always kind of, it always feels like coming home in some way, coming back to fairy tales and discussing them, because there's just so much content there and it feels familiar and exciting. So I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, definitely. And it's one of those things where, okay, admittedly, I have a theory, which I'll go into a bit later, which is kind of what I just sort of threw at Madeleine and said, this is what I think. We should tell everyone. So admittedly...
Spread the knowledge.
Fair warning, this is a Jules has opinions episode. Are there any other kind, really?
Sometimes it's a Madeleine has a...
Yeah, that's fair. Usually one of us has an opinion, or we both have an opinion. But yeah, there is something about fairy tales. We talk about them being timeless to the point where it's almost a cliche to say so. But it's a cliche for a reason. And the origins of much fantasy and speculative fiction and science fiction even, as well as a certain amount of folklore, comes into fairy tales, so it's definitely worth revisiting. And this week we're mostly focusing on fairy tale themes, which feeds into my theory, which I'll go into later.
So let's start by talking about the origin of fairy tales, because the whole kind of as old as time kind of true, fairy tales take a lot of influence and are a large part of folklore. There's a strong relationship between the two. Fairy tales are not the same as myths and legends, however. Just to illustrate the difference, myths, the idea of a myth is that it's meant to be true, or it's meant to have actually taken place, even if you don't believe that it's taken place. Similarly with myths tend to sort of focus on the start of time, you know, like huge supernatural kind of figures, who, you know, the origin of the world and things like that, and the gods and things like that. Myths tend to focus on that. Legends tend to be this kind of chronology of figures who aren't necessarily going to be supernatural. Robin Hood, they're all legends, again, sort of meant to be true, but not necessarily true, and a little bit more outside of time. Fairy tales do not pertain to be true. They don't exist in any particular time or place, and that's the significant part. They are outside of these kinds of boundaries, and they are usually moral tales. And they usually involve that there's usually a protagonist character and a villain character, and or a villainous force. And it usually involves a choice and the consequences of that choice. So it's a very particular kind of story. It's a very particular kind of narrative, and it's meant to be fiction.
I mean, the thing that is most interesting about fairy tales, I think I heard Diana Wynne Jones say in one of her books, only the feeble-minded truly despise fairy tales, because every fairy tale contains a grain of truth, and it's an essential truth that we need to understand as humans.
Yeah.
And I generally agree with that. And what's really interesting, when we've talked about the origins of fairy tales before, we haven't gone back far enough, I don't think.
No.
And I was reading a book called From the Beast to the Blonde by Marina Anderson, and she is a folklorist, and also I think she got a PhD or something in studying sort of anthropology of fairy tales. And she's done an awful lot of research on it. And fairy tales trace their origins back to tales that were part of women's lore. So they were stories women told each other. They went from mother to daughter, between sisters, between grandmothers and granddaughters, between aunts and nieces. They were essential pieces of women's wisdom, really, dressed up in fantasy so that they were considered, you know, to be harmless or nonsense or an old wives' tale. But they all contained this essential grain of truth. And this was a way, if you like, it was one of the ways that women had of getting around being quite oppressed in terms of their rights and what they were allowed to do and what they were allowed to speak to each other about and understand. And we attribute fairy tales now to being sort of old folk tales that were picked up by the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen and Charles Perrault. And what it comes down to is actually this was women's lore that was kind of co-opted by men and then shifted and changed slightly for a different audience, which they then sort of sold on, and it lost a lot of its sort of connections to its roots in that way, which is in some ways very sad.
Yeah. I mean, the whole kind of the big shift with Hans Christian Andersen and the Brothers Grimm and that whole kind of Christianization of the stories, it was one of the final changes, if that makes sense. And yeah, you have to appreciate that actually before it even got to that stage, it had already been moulded and changed by people for a very, very long time.
Yeah. And obviously with these tales being handed down over and over again, they shifted. They were shape-shifting stories that had to fit the narrative of the time, the history of the time. But the essential theme, the bit in the middle, the kernel of truth, you know, the surprise in the cracker, if you like, was the bit that didn't change. That was the essential thing that got handed down, even though it was redressed in different garments in slightly different ways, etc. And even now, people tend to pass those themes on without even really knowing that those themes are what they're passing on. I'll go into my theory about that a bit more later. But yeah, this is where it came from. And we have to also bear in mind that we lost an awful lot of women's wisdom. I say women's wisdom. This is not saying that men don't have wisdom, but it's sort of like this essential stuff passed from mother to daughter. We lost a lot of it during times like the witch trials. And other occasions when particularly the church were persecuting women because they didn't want women to have access to things like contraception.
Birth control. Yeah.
Abortifacients, that sort of thing. The ability to think and reason on their own, presumably, as well. So I think we've sort of got this trend now where we think that women have always been completely oppressed and didn't really get an education or think or whatever. And it's simply not true. We've generally had quite a raw end, a raw deal, if you like. We've had the shit end of the stick, but it's been peaks and troughs. It hasn't always been complete oppression with no rights or whatever. And to take all our understanding of it from sort of the Victorian era or the 1600s and not understand that actually we were valued during the medieval era, for example, and before that, and it really, really depended where you were in the world, it is a bit sort of sensical.
Even Roman propaganda, and the Romans painted the kind of the Celts and the people, you know, in the British Isles, not very well, to be honest, but even they commented on women, on British women. They were very fascinated by women in Britain because they were total opposite to the Roman and particularly Greek women. They were forthright. They were trained as, you know, they had opinions. So to these Romans, they would encounter these women who were larger than life, as it were, and they were fascinated by them. So this is, and this is, you know, this is from the Romans, who really didn't think very much of us at all, who wrote a lot of propaganda about us. Even they were kind of recognized the fact that women's roles were better in Britain than they were in Rome.
Yeah. And the final insult, if you like, and I'm not particularly attacking a specific religion or anything, but the church as a body is a political body.
Yeah.
And the fact that almost all history from a certain time period was recorded by this political body put a distinct slant on how we see things now. And these are generally monks who had eschewed a life of the flesh, or attempted to. I mean, if you read some of their writings, you're kind of like, what the hell are you talking about? You're not eschewing anything. And it's just like, there's a double standard going on here, clearly. But yeah, it puts a slant on it in the sense of, you know, we are the lesser, we are the weaker vessel, you know, we're the leaky humans. We're clearly not designed. We are literally just supposed to continue the human race. And we are, at the same time, temptresses, because, we're going to persuade men to have sex, etc. So there's this big slant of being less intelligent, scarcely above sort of a pig or an ape or whatever, and definitely inferior to a horse or a dog. And the thing is, the people at the time didn't necessarily think like that at all. That was a very distinct repressive church slant put on things.
Yeah, but those are the records that exist. Those are the records that have survived.
Those are the ones we go from. Unfortunately, a lot of them are kind of bollocks, or you have to sort of not take them as gospel, ironically. So I don't think you can even take the gospel as gospel thinking about it.
But that's another subject.
That's another subject. So, these original tales were generally women's lore, if you like, passed along. And they were advice for coping with life. They were entertainment, definitely, because you had to be able to tell these stories in front of men without men going, hang on a minute, what are you passing on to our daughter, kind of thing. But that's the thing, we are, as humans, wired to learn through stories. So how you teach your children when you don't have an education system or access to books or something like that, through stories and fairy tales is actually quite a good way of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a good way to remember stuff as well.
Yeah, you're more likely to remember a story than you are a list of facts. Most of us, anyway.
You're more likely to remember a story than some pieces of advice as well, if you're getting lots of pieces of advice.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly if you're, a teenage girl and, suddenly you get this first little hint that you might have some sort of power because all the boys in the village are looking at you now, and your one big choice, your only big choice in life, who shall I marry, or shall I marry at all, is suddenly in your hands, and you're not really prepared for making that decision at that age, but you have to make it at that age or whatever. It's not quite as cut and dried as that, and it does vary by century or even decade, but as a rough outline.
Yeah, definitely.
So this is my theory. It's not that original, but it's that it's not the subject matter of a fairy tale that's timeless. It is the theme. It is the kernel of truth that story contains. And these themes and things transcend barriers of distance and language and also sort of class, because these themes are universal to everybody. Which is why you have things like, you'll have tales whereby a woman rescues a man who's been cursed to be trapped in the form of a beast. And even though countries have not had any contact with each other, or very little, you still find the same sort of stories. So you've got Beauty and the Beast, and you've got the Tiger's Bride, for example.
Yeah.
Or you've got East of the Sun, West of the Moon. And these are not the same fairy tales, but they draw on that same fairy tale theme.
Yeah.
So that's part one of my theory. The second part is, now when fairy tales they've had a resurgence, they are being retold, reimagined, reused, particularly in young adult fiction, but also in adult fantasy. And the ones that are hugely successful are the ones where the author has either by luck or by design, because they actually really understand what they're doing, drawn on the theme. And it doesn't matter how else they imagine the subject matter, the theme is the thing that's been carried through and deliberately used. The ones that fall flat on their face are the ones whereby The authors completely ignored the theme, so the thing that gave the fairy tale its tensile strength, despite its unlikeliness and despite the fact that quite often fairy tales lack detail, they lack a lot of detail, including names in a lot of cases, they've ignored the theme, and the theme was the thing that endured, and therefore the story tends to fall flat.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I've actually kind of got my own theory concerning this, particularly about why it's successful in YA. And I'll touch on that in a second. But I really do agree with your theory, Jules. I'm 100% behind it. Of course, Carl Jung is scrabbling his way out. He and Freud, they're next.
Thank you for that image.
No, I have no idea where Carl Jung is buried, or if he's even dead. Who knows what he's up to these days, Mr. Jung. But Carl Jung would be scrabbling into the room going, nine? Actually, I don't know if he'd be saying nine. But no, it's because of archetypes. That's why fairy tales have persevered. It's because of they exist as archetypes within our shared unconscious. But we're just going to put Jung to the side for now, because we'll talk about archetypes another time. But that's him arguing with you. But actually, I'm going to agree with you, Jules. I'm going to say I do think it is these themes which are the prevailing part of the stories, which is why we get similar stories throughout culture, because these themes are, as you say, relevant to all people, regardless of who they are. And the reason I think in particular the retelling of the fairy tales works with YA and to a certain extent children is because the themes are mostly relevant to people of that age. And that is these themes of budding sexuality, leaving childhood, and death are some of the prevalent themes that come through in fairy tales, which incredibly popular in YA fiction. So that's why I think that fairy tales, people naturally go, oh, I'm going to retell a fairy tale, and I feel like it's going to be a YA story. I think it's because people are automatically kind of touching on those themes which are so integral to the original fairy tale.
Yeah. Definitely. And I have seen it work in adult fiction, but it's definitely, I think it sort of explains why some authors are drawn to retell fairy tales for a young adult audience. They're giving it a big twist by setting it in space, or they're giving it a big twist by making it a modern retelling. And that's not the big twist. The big twist is how you deliver the theme, whether you choose to completely subvert the theme or whether you choose to repackage it. And I think I've seen too many of these fairy tale retellings whereby they clearly haven't understood the theme, or they've chosen to ignore it. And unfortunately, this is something with literally hundreds, if not thousands, of years of history behind it, which is in the zeitgeist, which we kind of imbibe from sort of early preschool onwards, even if we don't realise we're doing it. Every retelling usually contains a glimmer of that original theme. Certainly the basic ones they do for very young children or for the start to read type age, there's a hint of that theme in there. So by the time someone hits you with something when you're like 13 to 17 with this retold fairy tale, if they haven't managed to handle the theme correctly, you've already got all this backlog telling you that the theme should be there, even if you don't consciously know it.
Yeah,
therefore it just absolutely kind of goes flat. You know, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, it just feels at odds. And I think you go into these kinds of adaptations with a certain expectation. And that part of that expectation, as you say, is the expectation to be able to recognise the story. And part of recognising the story is that theme, which, as we've said, is integral to the whole story.
Definitely. I'm going to talk about a few that I really, really don't want to slag anyone off. I'm just going to say they didn't really work for me, and I think it was the theme issue largely that was the problem. One of the most maligned fairy tales of recent years, or rather the most retold fairy tales of recent years, is Beauty and the Beast. I read a book earlier this year called Echo North by Joanna Ruth Meyer, and it should, on the surface, have been everything I wanted in a book. It took two of my favourite fairy tales, East of the Sun, West of the Moon, and Beauty and the Beast, and mixed them with one of my favourite folk songs, which is Tamlin. So it should, in theory, have worked. It was beautifully written. It's the most gorgeous hardback book. It's an utter mess. It's a complete and utter mess. And one of the things that I think, you know, sort of drilling down to the root of why it didn't work for me, is the fact that this author has clearly deliberately moved away from the inherent sexuality of all of those stories. Because all three of those stories are very, very sexual in nature. You've got Tamlin. Tamlin is about Janet, a lord's daughter, who decides that she won't have any of the husbands her father suggests. She goes off to Quarterhay, which she's told not to do. She meets Tamlin, decides she'd much rather have sex with him, and gets pregnant. But she makes the choice herself. She's aware of her own sexuality, and she chooses how she wants to use it. That's completely ignored. And then you've got Beauty and the Beast. Beauty and the Beast is rife with theme. There's obviously the idea that you don't judge things by appearances, that familial duty is an important thing, but duty to yourself and your own integrity is also important. And then under that, there is burgeoning female sexuality. There is the idea that, you know what, women feel sexual desire too, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay within sort of admittedly, the later tellings of Beauty and the Beast are sort of within the parameters of a holy marriage, etc. It's okay to feel sexual desire for your partner, which is actually quite radical for the time that it was Beauty and the Beast first written down, when they were still saying that women shouldn't enjoy it because it's sinful. But again, was completely ignored. It was done not so much chaste as in, well, we recognise that we feel sexual desire for each other, but we're going to wait to act on it because we're both 17, whatever, and we're not married. It was just done in a way that ignored it completely. It took that particular theme, the idea that it was okay, that it wasn't wrong, and that these feelings were natural, it removed them from the stories and sort of threw them away and gave you quite a insipid, Christianized sort of retelling of it, and it didn't work. I really found it didn't work, because that was a theme that was there for a good reason and had been there for a good reason for hundreds of years.
Yeah. I mean, Beauty and the Beast is always a really interesting one because there are so many renditions of it. And you are absolutely right that it is about that kind of attraction and that very normal attraction. But also about, for me, it's also about growing up. And the kind of the fear of growing up, both wanting to and not sure you're ready to, because, you know, well, I'm going to call her Belle, Beauty, whatever. She's faced with a position where she gives herself up to save her father because she doesn't want to lose her father. And then she's not really ready to marry. And ultimately, she makes that choice that she loves the Beast, and that's okay. And she's kind of ready to let go of that last vestige of childhood. She's ready to move away from her family. She's ready to be married and kind of sees the merit of it. And she lets go of that kind of fear, which has been fighting this desire that you spoke of, Jules. And I think the problem is that if you try and take one side of that, then, you know, you could just say, oh, we're just going to talk about that fear instead. They don't work the other. They work in tandem, both the sexuality and the childhood. It's why, you know, the losing of childhood, the becoming an adult, those two things need to work together, because actually, if you remove one of them, it feels awkward. And as you're right, you might remove one of them in order to have it as a more Christianized tale, but for me, you're not telling the story of Beauty and the Beast anymore, then it will just feel flat.
Yeah, it felt very hollow. And you know when you get to the end of a book and it's that particular type of disappointment where you've been led to believe you'll get something and then the book just doesn't deliver it to you.
Yeah.
And the book might be exquisitely written, but it's still kind of like, that wasn't what I ordered. I'm mixing my metaphors now. And yeah, it was that feeling. And I just remember feeling really annoyed about it and thinking, well, you can see it was a decently written book. And as I said, it was an exquisitely beautiful book. But the more I thought about it, the more annoyed I got, not so much with the author, but with the waste, because, you know, that really should have been my jam and it just wasn't.
Yeah.
And I think that was why. Other Beauty and the Beast, two specific examples that for me didn't really work. One was The Beast's Heart by Leif Shallcross. It's okay, actually. I actually quite liked it as a slow fantasy novel. Where it was an issue was it was told from the Beast's point of view, which should be really, really good.
Yeah.
But the problem is, if you're going to follow the classic fairy tale as it was written down by Madame de... I can't remember her name now, it's gone. during the 17th century, to the letter, which is kind of what this author did, the Beast is an incredibly passive character. Not very much happens from his perspective at all. So there's almost no action, and you're not dealing with, again, you're not dealing with inherent female sexuality or female duty to her family or how girls were co-opted and used in order to, as a commodity kind of thing. All the things that Beauty and the Beast does kind of deal with in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, those themes were all there, but it was kind of like the story was being told around the themes and they were still being ignored. So even though I quite liked it, I was like, you haven't really got down to the roots here, have you?
No, and the interesting thing is that actually it would have been really good, because we all think of kind of the Beast as being this very angry sort of character, and I think that really does come from the Disney.
Yeah.
And you know, and other versions as well. You know, but in the original, he's very, very nice.
He's actually quite a sad and lonely character who's embarrassed to feed in front of her.
Yeah, he's actually, you know, he's very gentle. He's very kind. He's not actually aggressive at all. He gets angry at one point because someone has broken the rules of hospitality, which is kind of fair enough. But he's not really aggressive at all. But then the thing is, like, telling it from his point of view, you could have still actually touched on those themes, you know, of desire and growing up from the male perspective, because the whole thing in the original is that he was transformed for a very stupid reason, because he was a very little boy and he was playing and he kind of didn't really want to be prince. There was a lot of pressure there. There was a lot of, you know, social expectation, and he just kind of wanted to play, and he made a silly wish, which was then granted, and he kind of got beast.
Yeah.
So there was so much there that you could do while still completely exploring the themes, you know, a kind of a mirrored version of them. He didn't need to be a passive character.
No.
I don't know. I haven't read the book, but...
And the thing was, the aesthetic was actually quite lovely, because it was kind of... Have you ever seen the Jean Cocteau 1950s black and white film Beauty and the Beast?
I've seen images, yeah.
Yeah. I actually watched the film. It's kind of weirdly meta and quite trippy, but I really enjoy it. And it was told sort of like that, and I liked that aspect of it. But at the same time, there really wasn't a lot of story, and the only action came on when the Beast was using his mirror to actually spy on Beauty's sisters, who had like all the agency and all the character, because Beauty in this particular book spends all her time crying and fainting and hiding in her room. Anyway, it was all just the reason that they can't be together is very contrived as well. So. But, you know, I sound like I hate the book, and I don't hate that book. There's bits of it I really, really like, and I kind of liked the way it came together, but it just doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Okay, last Beauty and the Beast example. I've mentioned this one before. This one is kind of a dumpster fire, to be honest. This is Beast, A Tale of Love and Revenge by Lisa Jensen. I guess I know what she was trying to do. I can't applaud her for it because I think it was a really bad idea. But
this is the rape one, isn't it?
Yeah. This one is... It's not Beauty and the Beast in the same way. Basically, the main character, being an ignorant girl who then goes to work in a great household, gets raped by the prince, and she demands... She not only gets raped, she's impregnated, and she's about to throw herself in a river and kill herself for it. This is a young adult book as well. And an old woman stops her and asks her what's wrong, and then she's magically sort of delivered of having this unwanted child without ever having to confront the options of aborting it or anything like that. So it's just one of those magical click your fingers things. We've managed to have the trauma and get rid of it. So that was cheap. And this woman turns out to be a sorceress who turns the prince into a beast. Except it turns out it's not really that simple. The curse that was put upon this particular character, the handsome prince was the curse, not the beast, kind of thing. And they're two different people. The main character gets turned into a candlestick and spends almost all her time in a cupboard. So that's a really action-packed story for the start. And she and the beast gradually fall in love. Well, she's a candlestick and he's a beast. If that sounds weird, that's because it is really, really weird. Leaving aside the fact that you have a survivor falling in love with her rapist, which is always going to be problematic, I think the author was trying to do the magic bullet thing. What if someone who'd committed something like rape could magically be made to see that they had done something wrong? They could really understand the consequences of their actions for everyone involved, and they're no longer physically or mentally or emotionally the same person who did that terrible thing. Are they then the same person? Do they then deserve to be punished for what they did when they were a different person? There's a real problem with magic bullet arguments like that. I get that they're a thought experiment, but what they leave out is the fact that the victim, the survivor, deserves some justice. They deserve some atonement and they deserve some peace. It focuses far too much on the perpetrator and not on the person who is harmed.
Yeah. So
that was a big problem with that book. And again, it kind of ignores pretty much every single theme in Beauty and the Beast. So what was it trying to do there except have it as a selling point? So yeah, I don't recommend that one. It really is a mess. I will say, and I know a lot of people say that Beauty and the Beast is about Stockholm Syndrome, and it's really not, okay? That's a very narrow way of looking at it, and you have to go back and look at the original stories, and I don't just mean the ones that were written down. You have to go trace them right back through various different origins and iterations.
Because yeah, it really is absolutely.
It's not just about a captured woman falling in love with her captor. It's not that simple at all. Although, admittedly, the speed with which things happen in the Disney film has tainted the fairy tale, I think.
Mm. Yeah, because actually, in the Disney film, it happens remarkably quickly.
Yeah, I mean, we're supposed to think the months have gone by, but it looks like about 3 days, maybe.
Yeah. Whereas, yes. I think in the original, she's there for a while. She's there for, like, you know, a few seasons.
This is my problem with fairy tale retellings, and I think that people have got to be really careful however you're going to do them in whatever medium. It's the fact that they weren't initially full of misogyny in the same way, and then they got retold by men, and I'm really not slagging off these men, okay, because I'm glad they retold them and we got to keep the fairy tales, but they got changed subtly to please the public and the church and the aristocracy and to please the people who were going to tell them to children. So they got cleaned up in a different way again. And we lost an awful lot. And the problem is that people then, when they retell them now, don't go back to the roots and try and find out as much as they can about the original themes and things. And instead just go from the easiest access points, which quite often can be Disney. And again, not slagging off
the
films, because I really enjoy those. But it does mean that all our own internalised misogyny and stuff then comes to the fore in a lot of these stories, and nobody's really questioning them, and that is a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also the other problem is that people analyse these fairy tales from the point of view of trying to find something wrong with them, rather than the point of view of trying to understand where these ideas come from. So they kind of fairy tales as being inherently problematic, rather than actually considering how the story has been adapted for different reasons by different people. But so then saying, oh, it's a damaging story, rather than saying this version of it has damaging qualities. But if I actually look at it properly, I can see the merits of these stories, because the fairy tales have merit. That is why they have survived. They tell us something intrinsic about the human experience. It's why we keep telling them. And they have changed. I mean, you just have to look at the differences between how fairy tales are told, you know, even 20 years ago to how they're told now. Yeah. They're constantly changing. And that's okay. But you've got to kind of look at them as not a branch, but a tree. And if you go back down, you will find the trunk, and you will find, you know, all sorts of different roots.
Yeah.
Coming from all sorts of different areas.
You need to go back to the roots, definitely. And that's why these themes are the really important part. I mean, if you just look at Snow White, it's something a bit, there's something very, that's a very dark fairy tale. That is very much the Bavaria and Germany origins, as you'd expect. But if you drill down to the theme is about being able to survive abuse from your family.
Yeah.
And come out stronger for it. And that's a really important theme. And, you know, if you think that sort of knowledge was being passed on for hundreds of years, that changes your perspective, I think, on what we believe of families of the past, put it that way.
Yeah.
And then there's things like The King Who Wanted to Marry His Daughter. That's a very explicit story about sometimes fathers sexually abuse their daughters.
Yeah.
That could not be told any more boldly than that, but that was knowledge that needed to be put out there. Obviously, Disney have not tried to adapt that one for some reason.
No. But I mean, to be honest, whenever I kind of look at Snow White, I did always assume that the kind of the origins of that were a form of sexual abuse, because of the way that the character of Snow is kind of actually sexualized in a lot of ways, you know, down to the very description, to the way that, you know, the way that she's also kind of meant to be, you know, killed and stuff like that. It was incredibly intimate and violent, sexually violent, concerned.
It's the mother-daughter
abuse. And I think it is the mother and daughter abuse, but I also think it was the kind of abuse of a mother who, or a mother, or a stepmother. The stepmother is a later thing, but a mother who kind of allows these things to happen to her daughter, who doesn't help her daughter, who maybe even, you know, wants it to happen to her daughter because of jealousy. And that all kind of exists within the story. It's incredibly dark. And a lot of these stories don't just talk about the kind of the positive sexual experience, but talk about the negative sexual experience. Little Red Riding Hood is an excellent example of, you know, a lot of the original early tales of actually saying, if you find yourself in this situation, here's what you can do in order to kind of protect yourself. You know, there's the funny twists of the fact that, you know, Red Riding Hood, I think there's a version Red Riding Hood is sort of kind of been pulled into bed by the wolf, and she goes, I need to get out of the bed, I have to go outside, I've got to go to the toilet, or something like that, having had all of her clothes taken off and burned, you know, so that she's sort of trapped. there's a humorous aspect to that as well, but it also kind of feels like a lesson on if you find yourself in this situation, here are ways that you might be able to kind of wriggle out. Here are ways that you can protect yourself. Here are subjects you can bring up which will kind of change the mood. Things like that. They're instructions on how to survive, not just as a positive, you know, in the positive, but also in the negative. And a lot of that has been lost, I think.
Yeah, and Red White Riding Hood's another one there. The original German, Rotkäppchen.
Yeah.
Of the Red Hood. And in the pre-original, sort of the ones we've only got partial fragments of, Red Riding Hood herself was the wolf's daughter.
Yeah.
Or the wolf recognised a bit of wolf in Red herself and takes her along to an extremely bloody ritual whereby she becomes one of the wolves. So, there's lots of different ways of looking at them. And yes, lots of them are about burgeoning sexuality, which again, you get with Red Riding Hood, which is very much about seduction, as you've just said.
Yeah.
And ways to survive it. And I think a lot of the really old ones are, again, about survival. If you think of things like Hansel and Gretel,
yeah,
then that's neglect. That's a different form of child abuse in that one.
Yeah.
And I've seen I think I talked about it, The Witch of Dover, which is by Leigh Bardugo, which is a mm-hmm. short story, as told as if one of her Grisha characters would read it. And in that Little Red Riding Hood, in that Hansel and Gretel is changed and sort of mixed with the tale of the gingerbread man.
Mm-hmm.
And you realise that the stepmother's been trying to get the children out of the house because the father is a serial child molester. So it's a very dark story, and they basically make a gingerbread character to look like the girl and send this gingerbread character in, and then the girl finally understands the truth that her father would have been dangerous to her because she's watching him molest this gingerbread character.
Jesus Christ.
It's Leigh Bardugo. It's dark, okay?
Yeah, should not be surprised.
I mean, the original story's pretty dark. Another thing to mention, obviously, is that a lot of the stepmothers in these stories were never really stepmothers in the original stories. They were actually mothers.
Yeah, it was the sort of the Brothers Grimm who suddenly went, no, it's not natural for mothers to want to do this to their children, so we'll make them stepmothers.
Yeah,
that feels better.
We'll take a lot out of a lot of father and uncle type abuse as well. So, because the father's always good.
I kind of feel like maybe the Brothers Grimm didn't like women.
I think they kind of thought, we'll never be able to sell this to our audience like this. So, because Cinderella, if you think about it again, humility and humility and a strong moral compass means that you can actually succeed at the end of it. And again, that's another one that's very much about familial abuse. One other book that I read recently that didn't quite work for me, and it's House of Salt and Sorrows by Erin A. Craig. And I loved the first mm-hmm. third of this book. The second third had me scratching my head, and the third third was just an utter mess. Again, it's a retelling of 12 Dancing Princesses, and it starts off very promising, and it's told in a sort of gothic-y type style as well, and the world building and everything is great, and then it just descends into utter misogynyville. The thing with 12 Dancing Princesses is that it's kind of a sexist tale anyway. And there's something inherently not quite right about a father allowing men to sleep in his daughter's bedroom in order to find out what they're getting up to at night. There's something a bit dicey about that.
Well, it's relatively innocent. It's just that, like, what are they getting up to at night? They're just having fun.
How dare they go out dancing through this magical doorway? It's an interesting tale. This actual book doesn't do it very well. I have got a list of authors who have done it right, in my opinion, as well, though, because I don't want to just be saying, oh, this is rubbish, nobody should be doing this. And the point I think I'm going to try and make with a lot of these is that where fairy tales originated being tales and bits of advice passed on between women, and kind of belonged in that respect to the oppressed and the unseen, the marginalised, the people who had less voices in society. I think they also still really hold true for that now. So a lot of these authors who have been very successful in accessing these themes and then repackaging them for a modern audience are the ones who've also managed to combine it with the idea that this is for people without as much voice as other people, the marginalised. Yeah. So you've got things like in The Vanisher's Palace, which is by Aliette de Bodard, and it's a queer retelling of Beauty and the Beast, whereby the Beast is a dragon shapeshifter and the Beauty is a single mother. And it's set in this fantasy world, and she sort of goes to work for the Beast because she's got, well, for the dragon, because she's got nowhere else to go, and the dragon's kind of like a misanthropic, I don't want anybody around me kind of thing, because she was bereaved. Mm-hmm. And they end up falling in love, and it's lovely. It's just a really, really sweet retelling that is true to the theme, and again, true to the idea that this is for a marginalised voice.
Yeah.
So that one was really good. And then you've got Anna Marie McLemore with particularly with Blanca y Rosa, which is a retelling of Swan Lake, but looks at sisters. Anne-Marie McLemore writes a lot of queer fantasy magical realism. She's got a book coming out in January, which I've just been given an arc of, called Deep and Darkest Red, which is a queer retelling of The Red Shoes, which is one of my favourites.
Mm-hmm.
So again, she accesses the themes really, really well. I also really enjoyed The Girl in Red by Christina Henry, which is a dystopian retelling of Little Red Riding Hood. That works really well. And you can't do better than Naomi Novak. She did a retelling of Beauty and the Beast of a sort with Uprooted, and a retelling of Rumpelstiltskin with Spinning Silver. And Spinning Silver was my top book of 2018. It was just absolutely fantastic. It was all about lack of privilege and classism and repression of certain minority groups, and yet all told within this fantasy landscape. It was just really, really clever.
I've got a couple as well, but both are Beauty and the Beast, because that's my jam, actually. Like you, I think it's probably one of my absolute favourite fairy tales, and I think we can be counted among many. It's one of those really, really popular ones. So the first is actually a Japanese anime called Kakuryo, Bed and Breakfast for Spirits. And basically, it is about a young woman called Aoi, who can see ayakashi, so kind of like spirits, demons, things like that. And she's basically been taught by her grandfather, who could also see them, that if she's ever in a kind of a position whereby there's an ayakashi that might want to eat her, if she feeds them instead, if she gives them food, then they'll eat the food and they won't eat her. So she's been taught to cook to their taste, and she's a really, really good cook. Yeah. Anyway, her grandfather dies. Her mother abandoned her, and her grandfather dies. And the next thing she knows is this ogre called Odana has kidnapped her to his realm, where he runs this massive ryokan inn. So with like proper like onsen, you know, hot springs, and like the really nice rooms and the formal meals and all of that, you know, the full pizzazz. And she's kidnapped, and he says, "You're going to be my bride. You are my bride. Your grandfather accumulated a huge debt at my inn, and he sold you off as the debt. So you're going to be married to me." And she says, "No, I don't want to marry you. Thanks very much. I will work off the debt. And he goes, oh, all right, you can try, but you're never going to be able to. She opens up a small restaurant in his kind of just outside with of his inn. And she's very successful because she's really, really good at cooking, particularly for Ayakashi. And while she's there, she befriends a kitsune, yeah, who she strongly suspects saved and helped her when she was a little child. And there's a whole kind of relationship where she is starting to fall in love with this ogre. But she also has this slight thing with the kitsune as well. And for me, even though they went a completely different thing, because in the end, it's all about her cooking. And there's a lot of kind of focus on the food and what she's up to. And there's a whole different sort of plot. But throughout it all, there's that kind of background thing of the fact that she is falling in love with this other guy. And he keeps referring to her as his fiance. And they really captured the themes for me, and it is quite a sweet little anime, so it's worth watching if you kind of want something relatively fluffy, and which will make you feel hungry, by the way. It will make you feel so hungry.
God, anime food always looks amazing.
It really does. Every time she's just the nice thing is that pretty much every time she eats anything, it's delicious. She's always like, oh wow, this is nice, and she then describes the texture and the taste, and I was like, oh my god, I'm so hungry. So it's really worth watching. And the second one, and I'm just gonna bring it up briefly, is A Court of Thorns and Roses. We've talked about it a lot. The first one is a retelling of Beauty and the Beast and of Lin. The nice thing about A Court of Thorns and Roses for me is that the themes were sort of updated a little bit to fit more with a slightly older audience, rather than it being a thing of kind of sexual awakening. It's kind of post-sexual awakening, but you know, that whole sexual thing continues to exist. So it's actually one where the themes have been shifted a tiny bit, but have not been altered. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does make sense. Definitely.
Yeah. And I am very, very fond of the series. And the first book is rather good. The second book is obviously even better. We're not going to mention the third book because Jules will get upset. But I really like it, so...
Yeah. I just want to talk a little bit about Juliet Murillier.
Yep.
Because she retells fairy tales, and you don't necessarily feel like she's retelling them a lot of the time, because she's that good at weaving the themes into the narrative. And obviously, it's quite obvious with, say, Daughter of the Forest, that she's retelling the story of the 12 wild swans.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in that instance, it's not 12 wild swans, it's 6, isn't it? Which is probably a more manageable number.
But slightly more manageable, yeah.
The book that follows on from it, Son of the Shadows, is actually a retelling of Tamlin. And it's a retelling in a way that's very clever, because the main character, Bran the Raven, as you get to know him, and slight spoilers, you realise that the reason Liadin, the main character, is holding on to him, metaphorically speaking, is because she sees that there's a very good man there who needs help putting himself back together. Bran is this amazing warrior who has collected this band of men who are kind of the rejects of society. They've just been thrown out. No one wanted them. They're ex-slaves, ex-cons, people with no family who are considered to be of bad luck. He's given them a place to belong, and he runs the best band of mercenaries in Ireland. But Bran himself has got a very shadowy past, and as you go further into the story, you realise that something terrible happened to Bran's mother when he was very, very small, and he got, as a consequence, he ended up left with a man who wasn't his father, who abused him terribly. And this is not a case of, this is not a case of, you know, it's the woman's responsibility to put a broken man back together. But it's she sort of manages to hold on to him long enough for him to start holding on to himself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So even though it's set in medieval Ireland, it's done in a way that is very accessible to a modern audience and is very rich with the themes from sort of various fairy tales, but obviously Tamlin.
Yeah.
She's very good at that. She did a young adult book called Wildwood Dancing, which is a retelling of a mashup of 12 dancing princesses, but focusing on the sisterly interactions, which makes it work really well, and also of the Frog Prince. And it's really, really sweet. It's this lovely story. It's really, really good. I won't go into too much detail. There's a tiny little bit in there of the king who married his daughter as well, but it works really well. And the final one I'll mention of hers is Heart's Blood, which I read 3 times before I realised I loved it because it was a Beauty and the Beast retelling, and I just hadn't noticed because the story was so good. and I think that's the thing. Beauty and the Beast has been retold so many times by so many authors over the centuries, and we can include amongst them Jane Austen with Pride and Prejudice, and also Charlotte Bronte with Jane Eyre, and various others. And the beast doesn't always have to be a beast. Sometimes it can be a man with manners or an aspect that isn't very appealing to the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, for example, in Heart's Blood, the Lord of Whistling Tor had some sort of birth defect whereby one side of his body is quite wasted.
Yeah.
So he's kind of rejected. And then there's a big curse over the Tor as well. Which the main character, who is running away from a difficult situation herself, has to unravel, and they come together as partners, and it hits all the themes of Beauty and the Beast, and it's just a really, really good book. So someone who does it really well is Juliet Marillier, in my opinion.
There you go then. So for all you fairy tale lovers who are desperately looking for your next fix, there's a long list for you to get your teeth into. I do think that's about all we have time for.
Yep, definitely. Although we could probably talk for another 3 episodes on this.
I think we could, and that's the problem. That's why I'm gonna stop us, because God, I love fairy tales so much. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation, and Jules, you've got one for us this week.
Yes, moving away from fairy tales entirely, on Friday I went to see Doctor Sleep, and it's fantastic. It's the best Stephen King adaptation I've ever seen. Now, admittedly, I like the book Doctor Sleep far better than I like The Shining, which is the first book. Doctor Sleep combines all the best parts of Ghost Story, of Stephen King's characterisation and character relationships, and of dark fantasy and general vague creepy horror as well. It's incredibly well put together, it's well cast, well acted, the music's brilliant. It's kind of the best of the Stanley Kubrick film, which again didn't love, gotta say. But it just works really, really well. I highly recommend it. So if you want to see something a little bit creepy that's really well acted, go and see Doctor Sleep.
Fantastic. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks, goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.